Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Pediatric vaccinations fell sharply across the country as states took measures to stop the spread of COVID-19. In Michigan, fewer than half of infants 5 months or younger were vaccinated for the month of May, according to the Centers for Disease Control, and health officials say it's a similar story in Ohio. Dr. Sarah Bodie is a primary care physician and the medical director at Nationwide Children's Care Connection School-based Health and Mobile Clinics. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ann.
What happened to vaccination rates here in Ohio during the shutdown?
Yeah, so what we know is that there was a sharp decline starting in March for the rate of vaccination in kids. Across the state of Ohio, what we've seen is there was a drop of more than 45% each month when you compare it to previous years.
Now, when the shutdown occurred, this had to have been top of mind for someone like you is, how are we going to get kids vaccinated?
Yes, absolutely. So practices worked hard around the state and locally here to think about how can we continue to prioritize those vaccines and services in a safe way. So we've been working on this during the entire time of the pandemic and just trying to get the message out and talk with families about the importance of coming back in to get those vaccines.
What are the greatest challenges?
Well, some of it has to do with parental fear, right? They've been in shelter in place. They're not sure about getting their kids out and doing it in a safe manner. So part of that is just letting them know that clinics are open and that we're using safety measures. Offices are wearing the appropriate PPE. We're seeing less patients, spacing it out in between visits so that when families come, they're not stepping into a crowded waiting room so that they can socially distance while they're there. Some practices are even having families wait in their car until the time of the appointment and then come straight back into an examination room.
Is there a sense that parents aren't even querying on this topic, that they're just not calling at all, so they don't know how their office, their pediatrician's office is handling it?
Well, I think that could be partly true. I think families have a lot on their minds right now, a lot of anxiety, a lot of stressors, maybe financial stressors. And so sometimes then things like their child's vaccinations or well child care might not be top of mind. But that's important for us because that's what's going to lead to a potential outbreak if we don't get a handle on this.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how the rates for particularly infant vaccines have took a sharp drop in the 3 months since the shutdown. My guest is Dr. Sarah Bodie. She's a primary care physician and medical director of Nationwide Children's Care Connection school-based health and mobile clinics. If you have a question or comment about vaccinating and about getting your child vaccinated, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, Dr. Bodie, when I refer to that in Michigan, the fewer than half of infants 5 months or younger were vaccinated for the month of May, I mean, isn't this something when you're discharged from the hospital after giving birth that isn't that like the first thing you're supposed to do is, 2 weeks later, get a well visit with your child and start that process?
Yeah, I mean, during the first year of your life, you come in every 2 months on average in order to get those checkups, but then repeat vaccinations at each of those visits in order to get immunity. And so it is very frequent that you're coming in, particularly under the age of two. Mm-hmm. And then there's important school-age vaccines as well. We have a large primary care network at Nationwide Children's, about 15 different clinical sites. So we care for a significant percentage of kids that are vulnerable in Franklin County. And I'll just give you an example. In the month of April, we typically vaccinate over 1,000 kids with the measles vaccine. And this past year in the month of April, we only vaccinated 32.
Wow.
So we are talking about a pretty sharp decline in numbers here.
What is your concern? Is this a challenge of just playing catch up, or are you afraid someone are going to slip through the cracks?
Well, one of our largest concerns is just, are we at a potential where if enough people do not get their vaccines, that we lose herd immunity? Mm-hmm. And that's a concern for us with outbreaks, particularly in the fall as schools potentially reopen locally and those kids are now going to be around other children, or as daycares are reopening, as parents are getting back to work, if there's not a large enough percentage of young kids vaccinated for that measles vaccine, we are at risk of having an outbreak.
What about the requirement for vaccinations for school kids?
So those requirements are still going to be in place in the fall. So hopefully that will be a driver for families to get back in. And many of the daycares do require vaccines as well, and you know, have parents report that. So we have this summer to really think creatively about how we can do this. It's not just getting all the kids back in. We're playing catch up, as you mentioned, because new kids are aging into needing the vaccines, mm-hmm. and we have the backdrop of kids that have missed them for the last 3 to 4 months. So we're going to have to think creatively about how we get all of these kids in safely to get them up to date.
And when you talk about thinking creatively, what do you mean by that?
Well, for example, Nationwide Children's, we are working locally with Columbus City School District and other area schools to open up some vaccine-only clinics around Franklin County. So those are going to be opportunities, additional opportunities where parents can come to different school sites all around Columbus and just get their kids vaccinated. We take appointments, we take walk-ins. We're also partnering with Columbus Public Health in that initiative. So they are going to be doing some additional sites at schools as well, again, to kind of help close that gap in kids that are behind.
You know, outside of the vaccine issue, which is important, obviously, I'm also wondering, with this many kids not getting in for those regular, what we think of as regular appointments, and missing them at these critical times in their development, are you worried about families missing other red flags in their children's health that they would otherwise get from one of these sort of routine visits?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest risks of this COVID-19 pandemic with kids isn't the threat of the disease itself. It's going to be the effect on their, you know, wellness and development and mental health over this period of time when they weren't accessing regular care for those months. So we are concerned and obviously want to get as many families as we can back into their medical home for that full appointment. In addition to our vaccine clinics, we're actually also offering mobile units that are going around to, again, try to close that gap for well childs, for the families that don't have a regular doctor or access a medical home. But if you have a pediatrician that you typically go see, it is safe and they are open, and getting back in for that full well check is the best decision that you could make for your child.
And is this something that they're emphasizing at discharge with women who are having, you know, when after they have a baby? Is there any sense that that's being emphasized at that point of contact, which may be the last point of contact you have?
Yes, that is definitely true. I can tell you that even across our network, at Nationwide Children's, we've even gotten special appointment times that we've set aside for those newborns, uh-huh. so that we can be sure we have plenty of opportunity for them to come in for that first visit out of the hospital, and doing it at a time where there's likely to be nobody else in the waiting area. And I know other local practices are doing the same. So we are emphasizing it, and we are offering an opportunity for it to get done safely for those new moms.
You know, you mentioned the economic issue these days. A lot of people, their family economies are fragile at best. But does that play a role in this, that people can't afford to get the vaccinations, or should it?
Well, it's definitely something to consider. But the great thing about that is that we have nationally a Vaccines for Children's program, VFC for short. And that program offers vaccines for kids that are underinsured or uninsured at no cost. So actually, if you are in a new situation and you're not on insurance anymore, or your child doesn't have insurance, you can still come in and access some of these vaccine clinics, and that won't be at a cost to you.
You can still go to, like, the health department, like the county health department or whatever.
Yeah, you can go to the county health department and actually to our vaccine clinics through Children's as well. We have financial counselors that work with the family to get them back on insurance as appropriate. But for the vaccines themselves, in addition to that, there is no cost.
Right. Yeah. And racism is increasingly recognized as a public health crisis. Is there any sense about vaccination rates before and after the pandemic lag for children of color?
So in general, children of color are already, you know, at a disadvantage in Columbus as far as their overall health and wellness metrics. We know that. And so we know that this crisis time in COVID-19 is going to exacerbate those disparities that we already see. So I don't have specific numbers, but we absolutely anticipate that, you know, children of color are going to have an even harder time with all of these metrics, vaccines, well, childcare, asthma is an important example. So it's something that we track and monitor and think about a lot at our institution, and purposely put our locations and access in places where there's a high number of those vulnerable children too.
The number of vaccines that newborns get startles new parents a lot. And a lot of people that are trying to negotiate, or for lack of a better word, I'll say negotiate with their pediatricians about how to kind of maybe lessen the load of vaccinations all at once. Is there a priority in your mind of what vaccines are the most important, or they all are?
Well, I would say they're all important. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that vaccines, the way they work is that they work by giving typically more than one dose over periods of months in order to really build up that true lifetime immunity against mm-hmm. those diseases. So when parents are requesting to space them out, that can sometimes make it challenging to get them those vaccines in a regular enough time frame to really protect their child. So we have discussions with families and talk that through with them quite a bit. There are certain diseases that are higher risk than others, so I'm very transparent with families about that. Much higher risk of having a measles outbreak here than polio, as an example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might prioritize that vaccine if the parent's really nervous about how many or what the child is due for. But in general, you know, the easiest thing is just to follow that recommended schedule, because kids are vulnerable when they're young. And so getting them those vaccines quick enough at that interval is what is the most protective during that time.
And any sense that the anti-vaccine movement has made an impression in this, on this score, that some of this is due to that?
I hope not. It could be, but what we're seeing is that even with that movement in previous years prior to the pandemic, it really is a small subset of the population, and the majority of the families that we care for get their vaccine, have good trusting relationships with their pediatricians, and if they do have questions and concerns, bring those and talk them through regarding timing. So it really is a small percentage that absolutely are the anti-vaxxer families that don't want these. So I think a lot of this just really had to do with, you know, purposeful no access at the beginning of this pandemic. I mean, we closed our offices to a lot of older age children and really prioritized certain visits, and just hesitation from families during this pandemic. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we can get this message out and get these families back in quickly.
Well, Dr. Sarah Bode, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yes, no problem. Thank you, Anne.
Dr. Sarah Bode is a primary care physician, medical director at Nationwide Children's Care Connections, school-based health and mobile clinics. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The COVID-19 pandemic has upended many lives and livelihoods, and many have lost a loved one to the disease. An unintended but rare positive consequence of the pandemic is a change in how we think about food. Kara Rosenblum is a registered dietitian with Words to Eat By, a nutrition communications company based in Toronto. She has been published in The Washington Post and is co-author of the 2016 book Nourish and the forthcoming Food to Grow On. Welcome to the show, Kara.
Thank you.
How has the pandemic raised public awareness about what we eat?
I think it's been multifaceted. There have been so many stories, first and foremost, about the food chain, about grocery store workers, about people who staffing in meat plants, and that has really pointed out that food just isn't something that appears on shelves. There are human lives that are part of the food chain, and it's really made people more aware of where their food comes from and who works in the industry and the risk they put themselves in just to get us all fed. And most people don't really think about that. They go to the grocery store, they pick up something off the shelf, they take it home, they cook it. Or more likely, they go to a restaurant and order food. They don't think about the grocery store staff, the butcher staff, the people working in restaurants. And that awareness has been heightened because of all of the stories that we've seen about the mistreatment of people working in these different areas.
An Axios Ipsos poll from April found that 45% of Americans said they were cooking more in the last month. And does that automatically translate into eating better?
Well, a lot of the time it does. Of course, it really depends on what people choose to cook at home. What we really found was that people were cooking what was available, what they could access, what they could afford, and that is different for everybody. But certainly when we cook from home, we tend to use less salt, we tend to use less fat, we tend to use less sugar. And of course, we don't have a lot of the things available to restaurants in our homes, like deep fryers. Most common American households don't have a deep fryer. So the cooking methods are probably going to be a bit healthier as well. And so that would lead to healthier options and better technique and healthier dishes in the end.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking about that rare silver lining from the pandemic. It's about how people eat. We're eating better. Kara Rosenblum is a registered dietitian. She is co-author of two books, one from 2016, Nourish, and another forthcoming titled Food to Grow On. If you have a question or comment, or more specifically, I would love to hear from people about how your eating habits have changed because of the pandemic. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we are eating a lot of takeout these days, right? But ultimately, you know, the bottom line is a lot of places haven't been open and they're still just slowly opening up. We're not eating out as often.
Exactly. And I think as more restaurants come, people are going to like to take a break from their cooking. But what I've seen people telling me, both dietitians about their clients, as well as people who've told me directly through comments on the Washington Post article, is that they've realized suddenly how often they were getting takeout food, how much money they were spending on it, how few vegetables they were eating, how much saltier it was, how much sweeter it was. And now that they're cooking at home, they're having this sort of aha moment that it's easy to cook from home, it's less expensive to cook from home, it's not that time consuming, and they're actually starting to enjoy it. And what dietitians have been telling me is their clients are coming to them, and these are people who usually work regular full-time jobs, maybe they travel a lot for work. They're very busy. They eat a lot of takeout. And now that their lives have slowed down because either they're working from home or they're not traveling as much, they're eating better and they're finding that their health is improving. They're seeing if they have diabetes, their blood sugar levels are more stable. If they have blood pressure, they're getting better readings when they're testing their blood pressure at home. They're finding when they're going to their doctor, they have to lower their blood pressure or diabetes medication because their change in eating habits have actually made such a huge difference to their overall health that they want to stay this way now. They want to continue to cook more at home. They want to continue to have takeout as a treat once a week instead of for three meals a day every day.
You write that cooking at home can be a great thing for kids too.
It is fantastic for kids. And when children grow up, they really start to learn the behaviors from what they see at home. And if they only learn how to order takeout food, when they grow up, they go off to college, they eventually live on their own. That's all they're going to know how to do. I truly feel it's a responsibility for parents and caregivers to teach their children the basic cooking skills so when they grow up, they don't have to only rely on takeout or fast food or ultra-processed food, which we know isn't as good for our health as cooking at home. So I kind of feel like we owe it to our next generation of children to teach them the basics on how to cook. And often parents will say, but I don't really know how to cook. And these days with YouTube tutorials and online cooking shows and TV channels, else, there's no shortage of lessons to get cooking in the kitchen with your kids.
Right. And there's the doing it with your kids part of it, too.
Yes, it's an amazing way to share an experience that children really learn from. It's cooperative. And actually also, as many people are homeschooling because schools are closed still in many places, mm-hmm. cooking is actually a great way to get in many school lessons all at once. There's the mathematics of, you know, half a cup or two teaspoons or all those kind of things are mathematics. There's reading as you're reading through the recipe. There's the sensory part of it, touching food, smelling food, learning how things work.
There's a cultural
part of it. So there's a science
it.
To it as well. Yeah.
And culture.
Yes, definitely. And then there's the other side where you can actually learn recipes from bloggers or cookbook authors who come from different cultures, from a global perspective, and bring those flavors into the home so kids learn a real cultural perspective and get to try different things from all around the world.
I'm thinking when you're talking about, I read that people aren't doing the fad dieting right now either.
Yeah, that's been another really nice benefit is that there are so many people who are driven every day to some, socially constructed body ideal, some Instagram notion or some magazine cover that they're supposed to look like. And they go see dietitians and ask which diet they should try to lose weight. And what dietitians are telling me is that fewer clients are mentioning the words like keto diet or paleo diet. They're not as interested in that. Now people are really putting their attention to well-being and just general health to keep their immune system strong, to stay healthy, to make sure that they're in the best health they can be, that if they do end up with the virus, they can hopefully be better equipped to be strong and be able to fight it. Because we do know from research that the people who are most hard hit with the virus are those that may have an underlying condition such as heart disease or type 2 diabetes. So learning to take care of these through diet, which is possible, is really helpful for people. So the focus isn't on having the perfect body or looking a certain way. The focus is now on just being healthy and enjoying healthy, nutritious, nourishing food.
You know, hand in hand with what you eat is, whether or not and how you're sedentary or not. And I don't know about you, but I've seen just a lot more people out at the park just walking together.
Definitely.
I'm wondering, do you see that playing a role in this as well?
It definitely has. And the dietitians that I spoke with all mentioned that their clients are less sedentary than they were. Mm-hmm. Even if they're just simply walking around their neighborhood, they are getting out more. And simply because they have the time to, and we can't really forget that aspect of it,
right.
Is that most people say their hectic lifestyle doesn't give them the time. But once people are embracing exercise and they see that even 20 minutes of walking makes a huge difference, they're more likely to continue to embrace that as something even when the pandemic ends because they're getting used to enjoying going for a walk.
Now, we've also talked on this show about how people are imbibing more during the pandemic.
Yes.
And that when you this is a function of both getting takeout from restaurants in Ohio, at least you can now get takeout cocktails, but also just at the store sale level.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, well, I do like to look at the silver lining, and I'm a kind of a glass half full person. I look at the positive side of things. We can't ignore the true fact that many people have come out of this drinking more alcohol than they would, perhaps gaining weight because a lot of people are doing a lot more baking at home and they're eating a lot more. Right, exactly. So there is that side of it where there's more stress eating, there's more emotional eating. People are baking more because they have time. What do you do with the baked goods?
What's you the eat deal them. With the bread?
So, exactly. So everybody is making their choice. And certainly there are many articles and media have covered the COVID-19 weight gain and all of that. So my purpose and what I was looking at specifically is not to say those things aren't happening. They certainly mm-hmm. are. There are people who are drinking more. There are people who are eating more. Weight gain will happen. But I wanted to say, but you know what? It doesn't have to be that way. There's also this positive side, and there's a different way to look at it, as this is a time to think about long-term health, to say, I have the time to focus on making changes in my everyday habits. And instead of, baking and eating, why don't I spend, instead of the hour baking, why don't I spend the hour cooking and making something nutritious? So that becomes a choice. So when people say they're, emotional eating or they're baking because they're bored, you don't have to bake something that's not nutritious. You can cook something that's healthy and change your eating habits. So I just look at it as a more positive side rather than saying, well, you know, this is what we shouldn't do, you know?
Yeah, you know, one sector of the economy that hasn't really been hurt that much is, you know, like garden centers and things like that. They're booming right now.
Yes.
People are growing more food at home.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I've seen many people planting lettuce and kale and tomatoes and other things that grow quite quickly. Herb gardens have exploded in popularity. I know mm-hmm. in my area where I live, I can't find seeds mm-hmm. to plant for an herb garden because they're sold out everywhere, which was fantastic. Because herbs are one of those kind of stepping stones into cooking. If you can figure out what herbs to use to make your food taste better than it did yesterday without the herbs, that's a great thing to do. And another thing you can teach children about is adding different flavors to foods. So certainly I've definitely seen people planting more gardens from the, you know, from the planter on an apartment windowsill with three different herbs mm-hmm. to a full backyard with, you know, 6 to 10 different vegetables that are growing. It's been amazing to see people knowing. And that's really all part of embracing where our food comes from and taking a closer look at that. And even saying, you know, how does this affect the environment if this tomato is shipped from, you know, 1,000 miles away versus if I grow it in my garden? So that realization is really settling in with people as well.
And, you know, you can get things at farmers markets, too. Ours, we were doing a curbside, but now the Worthington Market is open. I think they're going to be opening up the Clintonville Market. That's for our listeners out there. You got to wear masks, and there's lots of cautions, precautions taken, I should say. But it's another way to enjoy that experience, right?
Yeah, definitely. And farmers markets are starting to open up in my neighborhood, too. And I find people are enjoying that. Most of the farmers markets here are in a full outdoor environment. Mm-hmm. So rather than having to into a grocery store, we know the CDC is always saying that outdoor activities are more safe than indoor activities. So if you can do your grocery shopping at a farmers market, it's supporting the local economy, making sure farmers stay in business, getting the freshest regional foods, as well as keeping yourself safe. So it's a win for everybody, definitely.
You know, there have been do you compare this time to any time in recent history? Do you know I'm wondering, is this something you think is going to really change behavior?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, the only thing that it was compared to early on was the SARS epidemic. And you said, I'm based in Toronto, and we were an epicenter when SARS hit what was it now? 15 years ago,
yeah.
And it was not like this. We didn't have things closed. The only thing that really happened was we couldn't have large gatherings, so weddings and parties were canceled. But there was no, I mean, this is unprecedented, as we know. But what really makes a difference is how, when people are making a change, it's how they feel that change impacts them in the long run. So there's research that shows that it takes about 60 days to make a change. Some people say 21 days, but researchers say that's much too soon. It's about 60 days to make a change,
mm-hmm.
a real lasting change, like including physical activity in your life or eating more vegetables or relying less on soda pop or takeout food. And people are finding now, because they've had 60 days, some people 90 days, some people longer in lockdown, they've realized that these changes are actually something that they're enjoying. And when people can incorporate a change into their lifestyle and see that it has positive benefits, that it's not hard to do, it just becomes part of their lifestyle. It's no longer a change. It just is their normal life. And with those kind of changes, we do expect those to stay.
Well, Kira Rosenblum, I really thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Kira Rosenblum, she is a registered dietitian with Words to Eat By. That's a nutrition communications company based in Toronto. She has been published in the Washington Post and co-author of the book Nourish and also the forthcoming Food to Grow On. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 6 months in and 2020 is looking worse all the time. But at such times, caring for your mental health is more important than ever. Ariana Gallagher is a social worker and associate director of the STAR Trauma Recovery Center and Partial Hospitalization and Intensive Outpatient Programs at Ohio State's Harding Hospital. She oversees treatment programs designed to help people who are struggling to cope with stress, trauma, and adversity. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How's business?
You know, now more than ever, I think folks are starting to realize the impact that all of these stressors all at once are having and taking a toll on mental wellness. So we're starting to see a bit of an uptick in people reaching out for some support. Yeah, I suppose in a way that's job security.
And it's good that they're reaching out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there is a saturation point, I think, for people, for all people, in terms of how many stressors we can manage at one time. And we all need and deserve support when we're hitting that saturation point. Absolutely.
Is there any comparable time that you can think of? Maybe 9/11? I don't know.
You know, I think that comparison does get made pretty frequently in terms of the impact of an event on a community of people. I think 9/11 is probably the closest in recent history that we could point to say, gosh, this has been a really, you know, a high crisis, high stress time.
You know, obviously, I'm in the news business and was in the newspaper business back then. And I remember just driving and seeing people's faces, you know, the day after and in the days after that. Everyone was very sober. There wasn't anything light about it, and you almost figured everybody else was turning off the radio too because they just couldn't handle it anymore.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, when you get to that level of feeling overwhelmed, the impulse is to sort of insulate and isolate and try to shut down some of the stress, and so limiting, you know, media consumption is certainly one way that a lot of people go about doing that.
But this has been good for media, too, to have all of this. You talk about focusing your energy and choosing your battles. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I really see energy as currency. And we all have differing amounts to start with. We get to budget it how we see fit. But once it's gone, it's gone. And so I really recommend prioritizing using energy in spaces where it's likely to have the greatest impact. And that's going to be different for different people. And with so many different kinds of stress and crisis that people are managing, we sometimes have to pick and choose what we're going to spend energy on right now. What is the most important? What's going to bring me the highest yield on my investment of energy, what's likely to have the greatest impact. I think that's how we can make decisions about how we're going to spend our energy, because it is finite.
You know, during this time of social unrest on so many different levels, even on social unrest over the pandemic, a lot of people feel guilty. They don't have the time or the energy to get into the demonstration part of all of this.
Yeah, I think there are lots of ways that people can make a positive difference in this space. You know, there are going to be those that are kind of more on the front lines and out in the streets protesting and spending their energy in that way. That's not going to be everybody's impact. Certainly that way of raising your voice is really important and impactful, but it's not everybody's lane. So if that's not for you for whatever reason, but you still want to make a difference, I think there are still many, many ways to go about doing that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday today, and we're talking about, I guess, crisis fatigue. My guest is Ariana Gallagher. She's oversees treatments to help coping with stress, trauma, and adversity at Ohio State's Harding Hospital. How are you coping with the stress, listeners? Give us a call and tell us what you've changed in your life to cope. Or if you have a question for Ariana Gallagher about how to do that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This seems sort of random, but a lot of what I love about Facebook and what I hate about it is reading all the sad stories about people losing their pets. And I just feel so sorry for people right now who are losing their pets. I mean, there's all kinds of other micro crises, right, in people's lives. It's not all about the big stuff.
Absolutely. The world is still the world, and it still continues to, you know, time marches on. So whatever stressors might be sort of the day-to-day personal stressors are still happening too. And so when you layer on top of all of the kind of larger issues that are at work, it can actually make coping with the more personal issues that much harder. So certainly I think as people are coping with whatever their individual stressors are, it's even more important to access support because it's not just this one thing that you're coping with right now.
Are you hearing from a lot of people with children at home, young children?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of people have been tasked with, you know, figuring out solutions related to homeschool or childcare during the pandemic. A lot of people have had to transition to working from home. So they're teleworking and adjusting to a new workflow. They're also trying to be a parent to their children and be a teacher and provide structure. And that is, I mean, some very heavy lifting that we've asked people to just adapt to without really much guidance. It's like there is no manual about how to manage that. It's sort of a figure it out as you go. So I think a lot of people with young children have experienced that additional burden.
There's issues of increases in domestic violence. Again, all of these stressors coming to bear.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people that have found themselves in situations where there's intimate partner violence, you know, that doesn't go away because there was a stay-at-home order. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the risk is even greater for the violence to escalate when there's really no other outlet for stress.
Let's see. Stephanie in the Short North. Welcome to the show, Stephanie. How are you managing it all?
Very carefully.
Okay.
I was really not looking forward to 2020 because it was a leap year, and I dislike leap years, and it has thus far not disappointed, not even remotely.
Okay.
I mean, and so what I've had to do, because I live with a mental illness, I live with what can be very severe depression at times and my own suicidal ideation. And so I did not want to telework. Mine started with the whole teleworking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wound up doing was really looking at my own behavior and looking at the things that I needed to do that I should do to manage my mental illness. And then I wound up fleshing it out as I would normally do, and I then will write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, in writing about it, I had to really go back to what I call fundamentals and not manage my own expectations of myself and just try to make sure that I am doing the things that I know I need to do in order to properly care for myself. And then, you know, and I've had to really walk through this even in the midst of grief, in my of my own recent grief, because of the death of my aunt, the death of my father, and other kinds of things, to try to even help my daughter, who's my only child left at home, manage some of this too, and manage major changes in the way that she learns and lives, because she had to come home from school, from college.
Right. Yeah. Wow. I didn't even think about that. Well, Arianna Gallagher, talk to Stephanie. I mean, what does it sound? How does it sound like she's doing?
Well, you know, Stephanie, I'm actually really encouraged to hear that you were able to sort of get back to basics and really prioritize what you know you need to do to maintain some structure and some coping. So I'm really encouraged to hear that you kind of took that on as a top priority. You know, a lot of people get really swept up in everything that's changing and different. And so one of the things that I tend to recommend to people is kind of use the things that are staying the same as your anchor to orient yourself to what's going to be a healthy structure for you. So it sounds like you've already been doing that, and using writing as an outlet for stress is also a really good tool. So I think you're, under the circumstances, you know, doing a really good job, even though it sounds like it's been pretty tough.
So, Stephanie, working from home, how has that affected you?
Well, what happened with me initially was when I came home, I got everything set up and what have you, and then I started not taking a shower. And then I was in my pajamas for days on end and, you know, just consuming quantities and bags of, and I hate to say it, pirate's booty and all of that. And I could see myself kind of like falling.
Yeah.
Like you're falling. So I had to really kind of write this and then bring myself kind of try to write this and turn the corner, because for me, I have to shower every day. I have to eat properly. You know, I have to do these things. And for me, a day of not showering can be quickly become a week and then 3 weeks and then a month. And one of the other things that I personally became really concerned about, because see, when you're staying at home, for me, that's like permission to isolate and not talk to people and kind of hunker down. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. That, you know, that Stephanie, thank you so much for your call. Arianna Gallagher, that it really cuts both ways. I mean, some people say, man, I want to work from home for the rest of my life. But other people, they recognize, like Stephanie, that, yeah, that's not necessarily a good thing.
Absolutely. I think the key is finding what is going to be the right balance for you. And everybody's a little bit different in terms of their needs there. You know, I've been talking to a lot of people that identify as being more extroverted in their personality, and a lot of those folks are really struggling with the isolation of working from home. Part of what brings them satisfaction in their life is being able to interact with other people. And given the current state of the world, that interaction has certainly changed, and it's a different way of being in the world. So telework sounds like a dream for a lot of people, but the actual lived reality of it, it can be quite different. And so trying to figure out what the right balance is going to be as we move forward and hopefully get to a point in our world someday where these restrictions and these, you know, ways of protecting the public health aren't going to be quite so necessary. I think being a little strategic about how we arrange those work situations, it's going to be really key.
Are you concerned at all? There's always a shortage of or a limited access to mental health professionals, counselors, social workers, that kind of a thing. How do you think we've managed as a society during the pandemic? And I guess you can really just look at it on a local level, but is there enough, and has the profession adapted adequately to reaching out and finding the people who need them?
Well, you know, I think different entities have employed different strategies about how to maintain access to care throughout the pandemic. I know at OSU, the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health pivoted very quickly to a telehealth model so that we weren't having people come into the office for their sessions. Mm-hmm. And that was really out of necessity because we didn't want to risk, you know, making anybody sick or, you know, further transmitting this virus. So I know a lot of other mental health facilities and practices did a similar thing and pivoted to telehealth really quickly to at least be able to make sure that people weren't languishing without the support that they needed. I think there's always that conversation about a shortage of providers, mm-hmm. and certainly we would benefit from having more folks enter the profession. I think that is an accurate statement that we don't have enough providers to really meet the need in the community overall. But I think using the resources that we do have effectively is really key, especially right now. So I think a lot of practices are starting to look into options around group therapy, especially if it's going to remain in a telehealth format, to try to serve more people with an evidence-based approach.
Are you finding that the crisis fatigue of the day, which is pandemic related, it's social unrest related, it's a lot of things, it certainly can be racially related, obviously, but are you seeing any patterns emerge about who's being hit the hardest by this?
Well, I think certainly people of color are experiencing layers and layers and layers of crisis and a community-based trauma right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people of color are noticing the impact of that stress and are reaching out to try to build systems that will adequately support them in kind of developing or regaining that sense of mental wellness.
You know, when I'm watching the protests, I see a lot of joy there. I mean, for one thing, people are just getting together of like minds and sharing, you know, that this moment together. And that seems really good and positive. Obviously, there's the negative. The pandemic could get a good, you know, it's like putting the gas pedal on that. But a lot of people are also wearing masks and stuff. And so some people, for them, that's a productive way. That's just take care, be safe, wash your hands a lot. But for them, that's emotionally really important.
Absolutely. I think that fellowship, that showing of solidarity and pushing for a common cause absolutely can bring people together. And I think there are some things to be celebrating in terms of movement in a positive direction. I think there's still a ton of work to do,
mm-hmm.
and folks are certainly feeling that pressure and that stress. But you're right, there are also reasons to be celebrating. And I think that experience of coming together and united for a common cause is certainly part of that sense of community that brings wellness and healing by virtue of itself.
Well, Arianna Gallagher, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Arianna Gallagher is Associate Director of the Star Trauma Recovery Center at Ohio State's Harding Hospital. She oversees treatments to help coping with stress, trauma, and adversity. Thanks for listening today. It's been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.